The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
All right, good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you on a Friday. It's Friday, August 16th, and we are here live and local in our WTBR studio this morning once again on a Friday morning. Sounds like it's going to be a halfway decent day out there today and some rain in the forecast over the next few days, of course, over the weekend, as it always happens that way. We have a great show coming up for you. We have the Ukraine-Russia columnist for the New York Sun, James Brook, here on the show. And Jim and I are going to be talking about the current situation in Ukraine, how it's changed recently, and where it's headed. It's going to be a very interesting show for sure. We're currently working on getting Jim into the Zoom room right now so we can have him interviewed this morning. We're working out those technical details right now. First, let's go to the weather forecast as we wait for that to happen and see what we've got in store for us from the National Weather Service.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, sunny. Highs in the mid-80s. Light and variable wind, becoming northeast around 5 miles per hour this afternoon. Tonight, partly cloudy in the evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Lows in the lower 60s. South wind around 5 miles per hour. Saturday, partly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy. Highs around 80. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Gusts up to 25 miles per hour in the afternoon. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, so it couldn't be too much nicer here today. Definitely some sun out there and no rain today, but we will, looking forward, we're going to be getting that over the weekend. So, well, you know, it is what it is. It's summertime, and we'll deal with the rain as it comes. All right, once again, Morning Drive coming up in just a moment here on 89.7 WTBR-FM. We do have Jim Brook going to be coming in to us in just a moment. So let's play a song here, and we'll be right back after this.
Very simple.
All right. Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM. Again, Sean Sear here with you on a Friday morning. And I believe we do have our connection now with James Brooke. Good morning, Jim. How are you today?
I'm just fine here in Lenox. I hope you can hear me well.
We can, absolutely. Thank you very much, and glad we could make the connection here. Not always easy on the electronic and Zoom front, but very glad to have you with us this morning. So again, Jim is the current Ukraine-Russia columnist for the New York Sun, and has quite an august CV here as I'm looking down. The column has... the Ukraine-Russia non-resident fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, writes for the Berkshire Eagle as a foreign affairs column occasionally there, and the Ukraine Business Financial News founder, editor-in-chief. Fair to say, Jim, you have a good and strong background on what happens in the Ukraine and Russia area.
Great. Yeah, thanks. Shorthand is that I lived and worked as a journalist in Moscow for 8 years. I speak Russian. And then after 2 years in Cambodia, I lived and worked as a journalist in Kyiv, Ukraine for 6 years, leaving a few months before the big war broke out in February 2022.
Right, so that was certainly the demarcation point, wasn't it, when things all changed there. It looks like we lost your camera, Jim, and we are on a simulcast here, radio and TV. There you go. So I wanted to make sure we could see you. Thank you. And we've had you on the show before, and it was fantastic to do that, especially around the time when this changed, right, when Russia invaded. It wasn't completely unexpected from an intelligence standpoint, it sounded like, but at the same time, a lot of the world did not think that Russia would go in and invade Ukraine. They just thought it would be kind of a folly of an event to try and do, and yet they did anyway. And here we are now, almost, what, 2.5 years into the conflict, and things have started to change a little bit at this time.
Right, John. The big shocker is the Ukraine invading Russia. It sounds like something out of Mad Magazine. And I wrote that headline, and on the first day, the editor said, no, you can't write that, you know, Ukraine invades Russia. But that's exactly what happened on Tuesday of last week. And so that was a total surprise to the Russians. Financial Times correspondent talked to a guy in a military hospital on the Ukrainian side and said, we entered and there was about five Russians sitting around a table having coffee, Russian soldiers. So they were completely...
This is in Kursk, right? In the province, right?
Yeah. Northeast part of Ukraine, yeah. The western part of Russia. And historically, a transit point. War people know that in 1943, I think it was, the world's largest tank battle was in Kursk. About 8,000 Soviet and Nazi tanks met on the plains of Kursk, and that decided the fate of World War II right then and there.
Wow. So historically, an important strategic area. Correct.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Ukrainians don't really want to annex Kursk, although historically there are a lot of Ukrainian speakers there and has been part of that amorphous entity of Ukraine in the 19th century. They're looking for a bargaining chip for potential armistice talks with Russia. It's a good bargaining chip. They're also looking to pop Putin's balloon. The photos that have been coming out, the selfies taken by Ukrainian soldiers taking down Russian flags, putting up Ukrainian flags, standing in front of offices of the Russian post office, standing in front of Russian supermarkets, standing in front of cars with Russian license plates. This is all a real humiliation to Vladimir Putin, who his claim to fame was that he was the security chief of Russia. He was protecting Russians, and he obviously failed.
So why do you think that this incursion by Ukraine into Russian territory after 2.5 years of, basically getting pummeled by the Russians inside Ukraine, why did that come as such a surprise, both to the Russians and to the rest of the world? It seemed it would be a natural thing. If you're being attacked, you could fight back. Why is it so much of a surprise?
It is natural. And by the way, on the pummeling part, Ukrainians managed to dislodge the Russians from about half of the territory they occupied in the last 2.5 years. So they did a very good counteroffensive in the first year of the war. Second year of the war, they kind of stupidly said, we're going to have a counteroffensive in 2 weeks. You know, we're going to do this. It's going to be down in the southeast. Well, they got their teeth kicked in. And so they realized this time it had to be done in total secrecy. And I think basically people in Washington did not know, despite what people were saying in Moscow today. It was a surprise because no one's invaded Russia in 80 years. I mean, since the Nazis moved in 1941, no one has invaded Russia. That's a good 83 years. And there is, I believe, a clause in the Constitution of Russia saying that if foreign troops enter our territory, we can use nuclear weapons. And that is a big threat that still hangs over the operation. Now, another of Putin's many red lines that he's allowed to be crossed, frankly. They have not talked nuclear in the last 10 days.
Yeah, and that's always the specter, right, of, I suppose, what the various planners in NATO and places like that have been concerned about. And it seems like that's been an issue from the very beginning, when at first Volodymyr Zelensky had asked NATO for F-16 fighter jets early on in the war, asking for many things. And it seemed like the U.S. and NATO were very reticent to offer those types of what, and then slowly, it's all sort of like a drip along the way. They said, okay, we'll give you this and we'll give you that. And now, most recently, I think NATO countries did transfer some F-16 jets, right? So is that also kind of a new tipping point in the war?
Good point, Sean. Yeah. It's what they call the fear of escalation, and that's been with us really since Russia invaded part of Ukraine back in 2014, 10 years ago. Let's not, piss off the Russians. You know, they could go nuclear. They could do something extraordinary. But we've crossed all of Putin's red lines so far. The Ukrainians have attacked Crimea. They now have the F-16s. They're flying. The deal behind the F-16 is they're mostly being given by other by NATO countries like the Netherlands and Belgium and I think Norway. And part of the deal is we will sell them F-35s. So it's a good deal for the American citizen because we are now building F-35s. It will be at least several hundred that will be sold to places like Greece. And
that's the newer technology, I suppose, that those countries desire, the F-16 being an older fighter jet but still very capable in these types of situations, I would think.
Correct. Yeah, the F-16s are seen as stronger, faster than what the Russians are putting in the air. The Russians do dominate the air. It's interesting how the Ukrainians have retaken the Black Sea. Essentially, the shorthand is a country without a navy has defeated the world's second largest navy in the Black Sea by using what they call sea babies, basically motorboats with several tons of TNT packed into them. And they sunk about a third of the Black Sea fleet and chased the rest of it back into what's called the Sea of Azov, which is a neighboring small shallow sea, and some into a canal that leads to the Caspian. So I just had lunch yesterday with a guy from Lenox who now lives in Bulgaria, and he said, yeah, I see the cargo ships going back and forth off the coast of Bulgaria. There's some beaches down there. And so the grain exports of Ukraine are back on track thanks to the cleaning out from the Black Sea of Russian naval vessels.
And that was an issue, too, early in the war where a lot of the world was concerned about the grain shipments from Ukraine, right? Because that is a major contributor to food sources throughout the world and in many sort of difficult areas, Africa, you know, other areas that really need that food badly. So they were thinking that that was, you know, going to be a sort of a knock-on effect of what was happening there with the war in Ukraine.
John, yes, exactly. Just the geography dictates that Ukraine feeds Egypt, which is a mere 50 million people.
Mm.
And so North Africa really depended on Ukrainian and Russian grain exports through the Black Sea. And the Russians screwed that up for about a year. But the Ukrainians were able to first build a corridor and then progressively push the Black Sea fleet out of the Black Sea.
Mm.
The Black Sea fleet is not in the Black Sea. And it's quite historic because Sevastopol was founded by Potemkin in 1787, let's say, under Catherine the Great as a Tsarist Russian port. And so it's been a key part of Russian defenses for over 200 years.
Mm.
Now, that said, in the Crimean War, the Russians lost it. During the first phase of World War II, the Nazis besieged it and took Sevastopol. So it hasn't always been inviolate, but it's obviously been a target for foreign militaries. And control of Ukraine is very important for the security of Ukraine because they can control the ships going in and out of the ports of Odessa.
So the history here I'm reading also is very important, and you just named a couple of times in history in the 1700s and 1800s where, you know, these grudges don't necessarily go down easy in some areas, right? They're brought back many, many times. We think about what happened during World War II and then the Crimean War and, you know, earlier than that. And, of course, there's also the case that Russia invaded Crimea and took that from Ukraine in 2014, you know, 10 years ago. This new incursion into the Kursk region, is that going to be a bargaining chip for Ukraine and Zelensky? Is that the strategy here? Because it does, and I do want to talk about the trench warfare that's starting to appear in that region as well. But is that part of it, the history and the trade of those areas?
Sean, and I just want to quickly get back to Crimea.
Yeah.
It's not just personal grudges, it's geography.
Mm.
Crimea's been fought over since the time of the Scythians, which I think were about 2,000 years ago. Then you had the Pontic Greeks. Then you had the Genoan merchants.
Mm.
You had the Arabs. It was a big slave trading area for Slavs who were captured in Ukraine. More appropriately, it was the Turks. People have been fighting over Crimea, the geography, because it does allow you to control sea traffic in the Black Sea, and that geography has not changed. Putin saw it as an aircraft carrier in the middle of the Black Sea.
So it's a strategic region, geographically.
Yeah, and it will continue so, no matter who's on top of it or who's fighting over it. Going back to what's happening in Kursk, the Ukrainians have one thing that's important to note is that people think, oh, because of drones and satellites, there's no more surprise in warfare. Wrong. Hmm. Everyone is surprised by Kursk 10 days ago. Everyone is blindsided.
Yeah.
And it could be argued that some individuals in the West knew what was going on. But basically, the Russians were totally blindsided, which is why they behave so poorly. I mean, there's 1,300 Russian prisoners. It's a big deal. And there are tons of videos of captive Russian soldiers. They were totally taken by surprise.
And that is a big deal, right? To be able to capture that many Russian soldiers at a time when it sounds like Putin is also struggling to find new recruits. They've thrown a lot of bodies at this, and they're conscripting people and they're paying people to be soldiers. It seems like a desperation move in some ways.
Yeah. What often goes unreported is the appalling casualties the Russians have suffered. The Ukrainian chief of staff keeps a daily running tally of killed and severely wounded, incapacitated. And by the end of next week, it will be 600,000 Russian soldiers.
Mm.
That is eight times, and many of our listeners can remember the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, which went on for a decade. Putin has lost in 2.5 years eight times the soldiers that the Soviet Union lost in Afghanistan. And the Soviet Union had twice the population of Russia today.
Mm.
It was an amalgamation of 15 republics. So all this is being totally censored inside Russia, ferociously censored, the casualty counts, and kind of glossed over in the U.S. in the West. I think the British defense minister isn't pretty good about talking about it. But yes, they are desperate for people. And I think one reason 1,300 soldiers raised their hands and submitted to being blindfolded and taken into Ukraine is because they were draftees who weren't really into it. And that's why they're up in Kursk, where they couldn't get into trouble. Let's put it that way.
Right.
They were not the veteran sort of beef eaters that you see down on the front lines at the southeast.
It also seems that now Putin, because of this incursion, and I guess it's a very interesting, you know, stroke on the part of Zelensky, is that now he's had to move his chess pieces around, right? He's needed to bring new reinforcements into this area where you didn't have to defend your own border before because it was all being done inside Ukraine. And now suddenly it's like, no, this is bad. You know, they're digging in, and we've got to, you know, send some reinforcements to this area. That makes the whole game a little different, doesn't it?
Sean, good point. Another goal of the Ukrainians annexing or occupying the fringe of Russia is to force Putin to move troops from the frontline areas in the southeast, where Ukraine has not been doing very well. The numbers are that since January 1, Ukraine has lost 453 square miles. That's in 8.5 months. And the Russians have lost an extraordinary number of men killed and severely wounded. It's approaching 250,000 since January 1. We tend to forget that the bloodiest phase of the war is frankly this year, at least for the Russians. So, as you say, he's short of men. He's had to send them up by truck from the war zone to defend the motherland. And there's serious talk they'll have to do another draft. Now, the last time they imposed a draft, which was 6 months into the war, the Russian reaction was, before Putin stopped talking, every single seat on every single flight from Moscow to Istanbul was booked solid.
Mm.
In other words, they all split. They all, you know, many people during the Vietnam War went to Canada. Well, they went to Turkey, they went to Georgia, they went to Armenia, they went to Kazakhstan.
Yeah. That would have been the time to do it, too, right?
Yeah, and they were smart to go. A million Russians left in 2022 because of the war. And they were some of the smartest. They're like, the IT industry was really devastated by this. So Putin has obviously avoided doing a draft and done exactly what you just said. He's paying great signing bonuses. And then once I say, again, the ferocious censorship of what's really happening on the front lines. He's short of people. He's done everything. He's tried, you know, press ganging people from Nepal and India and Uganda, you know, migrant workers from Central Asia. But he may have to actually draft men from Moscow and St. Petersburg, who are kind of the gilded youth who've quietly sat through the war without having to worry about it too much. The war has been fought by racial and geographical minorities, you know, flyover country places, and that has kept the peace at home, helped to keep the peace at home. There have been no draft riots. And if you go back to our Civil War, where was the most important draft riot? In New York City. Hmm. And a lot of draft riots in Moscow.
Yeah, and again, to give it a little perspective, I looked up the Kursk region with regard to how close it is to Moscow. And I think it said about 320 miles. And for reference, it's about 320 miles from here to Buffalo, New York, from the Berkshires. You know, so this is not like a huge distance away, right? This is happening in Putin's backyard.
Yeah, it's all flat. The saving grace for defenders are the rivers. And what we're seeing now is the Ukrainians. Very interesting. I discovered that there have been satellite photography of where the Russians are digging trenches. And they're digging them set back so they can really defend them. But by setting their trenches back, they're allowing the Ukrainians to potentially double their take in Kursk region. Now, one defensible area is this river called the Seym, S-E-Y-M, which would make a convenient boundary, northern boundary. I think what the Ukrainians are doing, they've already set up a military administration. There's been some talk they might have a Russian government in exile there. I think they will not do that. But they're going to use it as, once again, as a bargaining chip. You know, you get off our land, we'll get off your land.
And why is a military administration being set up in an occupied area? Why is that a milestone?
Well, it implies, it signals that they are here to stay. And there have been reports of trucks carrying logs and industrial excavators going across the border, which means they're digging and building bunkers. So the Ukrainians are not going to bug out. It's not a quick in and out, which they've done before. They did two small incursions over the last 14 months. These are Russian exile groups that kind of went in, and shot up some things, took selfies with Russian post office signs, and then went back. This is a totally different breed of cat. This is tanks. This is armored personnel carriers. And just to go back to the surprise element, what the Ukrainians did, which is very clever, is that they said the Russians are going to come across the border, so we have to mass forces in our region across the border to prepare for this. So everyone's like, yeah. No, they did that in Kharkiv. They'll probably do it up in what's called Sumy. And everyone sort of knew there were some large troop concentrations in Ukrainian border region called Sumy. They didn't know that they were going to, you know, switch right and drive east into inside Russia. That was the real shocker to everybody, including the president of Russia.
Yeah, so they were expecting one thing and got another, basically. They were expecting just a defensive posture, and instead they came across and had different intentions. Jim Brook is my guest here if you're just joining us on Morning Drive. He is a Ukraine-Russia columnist for the New York Sun. A couple of pieces you've written in the last few days, Jim, really outline some of the on-the-ground issues, what is actually happening there. And I think, you know, in the second half of the show, if you can stick around for that, you know, we're going to talk about, I guess from an American perspective, how we're not really paying a lot of attention to this right now. And I know the presidential politics in an election year kind of soaks up a lot of people's attention. If you're watching the news, you know, we don't pay attention sometimes to foreign news and things that are happening in the world. And yet this is a major change in something that's been going on and does affect American national politics as well. Obviously, when something big happens externally, it becomes sometimes an issue in a U.S. presidential campaign. We could talk about that in the second half of the show. So James Brook, again, is my guest this morning, talking about Ukraine and the war between Russia and Ukraine, the sort of flip-flop that's just happened with Ukraine invading Russia. And we will return with our discussion here with Jim Brook on the second half of the show in just a moment. So this is Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM. We'll be right back after a short break. Stick around.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM. The Berkshire's only rock station, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Support for WTBR comes from the Office of Cultural Development in Pittsfield. The next First Fridays at 5 is September 6th. featuring a family fun zone, Maker's Market, live music, entertainment, and more. For more details, go to lovepittsfield.com and UCP of Western Mass. Turn passion into purpose when you apply at UCP of Western Mass, now offering full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. It's more than just a job, it's our identity. Apply today at ucpwma.org/jobs.
Do you have a favorite show on WTBR-FM? Did you miss the last episode? We've got good news for you. Most of our shows are now available on podcast. You can subscribe to your favorite and have the latest episode downloaded to your device automatically on Apple, Google, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or Overcast. Go to WTBRFM.com/podcasting and find out more today. WTBRFM, for the love of radio.
The Berkshire Mobile Farmers Market returns this summer. Our mission is to support local farms by bringing their fresh food to communities across Berkshire County. We sell seasonal produce, eggs, meat, cheese, bread, and more. Plus, we offer a sliding scale payment system. We'll be in Adams, North Adams, Beckett, Monterey, and two Pittsfield locations from June through October. Find out more at berkshiremobilefarmersmarket.org.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
Every Sunday night at 10 p.m., something strange happens to the airwaves of WTBR-FM. It's called The Mix. It is an experience like no other on this part of the planet. Witness a collection of fresh and classic beats that are guaranteed to make you move. The best part is, it is mixed completely live, uncut, unedited. So, for an exciting end to the weekend, tune your radio to WTBR-FM Sunday nights from 10 to midnight for The Mix.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. BCC provides access to higher education to everyone in Berkshire County and beyond, offering more than 50 high-quality programs, small class sizes, and an affordable education to help their students of all ages achieve their dreams. At BCC, their middle name is community. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings, and screen rooms. Customized solutions available. Online at Sondrini.com.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the morning drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Yes, welcome back to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you on a Friday morning, Friday, August 16th, and we are live this morning in our studio talking with James Brook. He is the Ukraine-Russia columnist for the New York Sun and many other credits to his name, talking about the situation in Ukraine and Russia and how it affects us here in the United States as well, making that connection. We'll be talking about that in the second half of the show. First, let's go to the weather forecast and see what the National Weather Service has in store for us today.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, sunny. Highs in the mid-80s. Northwest wind around 5 miles per hour, becoming northeast this afternoon. Tonight, partly cloudy in the evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Lows in the lower 60s. South wind around 5 miles per hour. Saturday, partly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy. Highs around 80. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Gusts up to 25 miles per hour in the afternoon. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, there you go. We can handle that a little. It's not too bad. Nice day today and some rain coming up over the weekend into Monday. I heard Monday was going to be the rainiest day out of all of those. So enjoy it today anyway on a Friday. Again, Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR-FM. And Jim Brook is my guest again. Thanks for being here today, Jim.
Thank you, Sean.
So we kind of talked to about the current situation, the incursion into Kursk region in Russia, inside the Russian border by Ukraine. And I just want to step back for a moment as we're talking about this and go back to 2022 for a moment, Jim. And I'm sure I've asked you this question before, but what was Putin thinking when he decided that he was going to invade Ukraine? Did he really think he was going to get away with it without too much of a problem. Do you think that he would expect himself to still be there and be dealing with this now, 2.5 years later?
Yes, he thought it'd be a cakewalk. Mm. And if you look at the recent history, he invaded Georgia in 2008. I happened to be in Georgia at that time.
Oh boy!
And I saw the Russian planes flying overhead. He basically got away with that. Mm-hmm. You know, he still occupies 20% of Georgia. There were a lot of Western protests, but nothing really happened. So that was 2008. So 6 years later, in 2014. He grabbed Crimea and a big chunk of southeastern Ukraine, what's called the Donbass, the coal and steel and iron area. Mm. And he kind of got away with that. So he thought, and being a dictator, he's surrounded by yes men who kind of tell him what he wants to hear. And he was fed very bad intelligence. And when they invaded Ukraine big time 2.5 years ago, they really thought it'd be over in 3 days. I mean, the soldiers carried dress uniforms for their victory parade down the main avenue of Kyiv, a city where I lived 6 years. So he thought it'd be easy, and here he is. Instead of 3 days, 30 months later, he's still there. And as I mentioned earlier, lost about 600,000 men killed and severely wounded. An incredible death toll. Biggest war in Europe since World War II.
Yeah. And it does seem like there's a pattern to the way he operates and Russia has operated in the past, which is to make that invasion, be there for a while, and then basically cut a deal so that Russia now has a little bit more territory, right? They did that in Finland just before World War II as well, and Russia still has that land that it used to be occupied by Finland. And I assume that they're looking, as you mentioned, they've still got a slice of Georgia. They've still got Crimea. You know, is that the ultimate goal here, is to not necessarily take all of Ukraine, but to slice it off and make that part of Russia? Or does this new incursion maybe put a stop to that?
Well, good point. You know your history, Sean. And I think the goals on the Kremlin side changed a little bit, and they got so frustrated they want to take over the entire country. It's very interesting how he really is fed bad information. Hmm. It's partly because the Russians look down on the Ukrainians as kind of local yokel peasant types who speak funny Russian, and they're not too bright. I mean, you know, these are the people who designed the ICBM bombs, missiles, and aim them at Times Square. The Ukrainians, on the other hand, look down the Russians as local yokels who are too bright. Putin has been crippled by this prejudice against Ukraine. And once again, what we saw 10 days ago is that his intelligence failed him. They failed to tell him that his country was about to be invaded. And these are... The difference between Russians and Ukrainians is like between Americans and Canadians. It isn't really that big of a difference. Mm-hmm. And so for the Russian side, it should be relatively easy to penetrate and they do, their intelligence services. But they completely miss this. And this brings, for military historians, something important. We thought that Pearl Harbor would be maybe the last surprise attack, and that with satellites and satellite photography and all sorts of wonderful sensors and drones, especially drones, that you can never do another surprise attack. Well, that idea just dropped into the trash can 10 days ago when the Ukrainians invaded Ukraine. That was a surprise. No one predicted that.
Yeah. And so this is, I imagine, a great embarrassment for Putin as well, although... And I'm sure you can speak to the flow of information inside Russia and how things are very tightly controlled. I'm sure as a journalist in that area, it was difficult to get the actual story of what was happening on the ground because there is so much control and I assume misinformation of what's being propagated there. The propaganda is probably... huge, and I don't know that the average Russian really knows what's going on, but I would think this would still be a huge embarrassment to Putin.
It is, and the flow of information can be rudely described as constipated because they have ferocious censorship. I think they've banned like 100,000 websites. Just last week, they slowed down YouTube downloading speeds. People in the know use VPNs and go around the firewalls, but still about half the population gets their, quote, information, unquote, from TV, which is entirely state-controlled and is hysterical and propagandistic. And but that is their source of information. That people on the internet ideally should know what's going on. You know, Radio Free Europe does a very good job. There's BBC, Deutsche Welle. They all have Russian services. And once again, these selfies that Ukrainian soldiers are taking with Russian icons in the background, like the Russian post office or the Russian supermarket, that has a real impact on the Russian viewers.
Yeah, I would think, and as you had mentioned also, you know, people find a way to get around the blockages for information, I would think. The idea that once some information filters in and leaks through, that it gets around, right? I mean, we know how information casually can get around even in a small place like the Berkshires. So in a time of war, I would think that it would be even more interesting in ways that you can find a way to get that information to people, to your neighbors, to whoever needs it, you know, to know what's actually happening. Although I would imagine having that information is probably also a dangerous thing.
Right. You know, one thing we haven't talked about is the reaction of civilians in the occupied areas of Kursk.
Yeah.
And it really is quite striking that a foreign force, Ukrainians are foreign, invade a country and there's no reports of civil disobedience, of partisan warfare, of people picking up a gun, people taking pot shots at the Russians. A small minority of Russians have stayed put and are apparently coexisting with the Ukrainian occupiers, but there's one video I saw of this woman ranting to Russian TV saying that they were Polyaki, Polyaki, Polyaki. Well, that means Polish. And no, honey, the people who live 40 miles to the west of you, they speak Ukrainian. You know, it's kind of like if the French Canadians invaded New Hampshire and people were ranting and raving about the Spanish speakers. You know, it's kind of an ignorance of your neighbor that you call them Polish when they're really Ukrainian. But it also gets into the Russian mindset where you can't recognize Ukrainian as a real language and the Ukrainians as a real nationality. And you think behind them are the horrible Polish Catholics. I mean, that's how they see it.
And interesting. Also what you had written in your piece for the New York Sun was that Volodymyr Zelensky has also sort of activated the international humanitarian organizations as well, right? So as you mentioned, there doesn't seem, and again, it's hard to know what information is true, right? The fog of war. But to know that maybe the Russians in that area, they had to flee. So it's a you know, I'm sure terribly upsetting to them, as it would be for anyone who is seeing an occupying military force come through. But it doesn't seem like there's a huge humanitarian problem with this particular incursion, as there would have been or have been, let's say, with the Russians coming into Ukraine. Is that true?
Well, the ICRC, the International Committee of Red Cross, worked in the Russian-occupied areas of Ukraine. So there's a certain parallelism here where he says they're welcome to come in and monitor and distribute aid. I think one of the most striking comments I saw from a Russian evacuee was, why are the buses so late? You know, I mean, what kind of a limp wrist response to you having your country invaded that you're whining that the the Peter Pan bus is late, you know. I mean, it's like they all just said, well, we're going to go, and it's up to the government to sort things out. And going back to the fact that basically I've yet to see any reports of civilians in the occupied, in the conflict areas, raising a rifle to defend the Putin government.
Mm.
And this is where Putin may be on surprising thin ice, in that people, they just want to keep their heads down, they want to stay out of trouble, want to stay alive, and they want to retain their possessions. And apparently the reports of Russian soldiers once again looting houses, but this time they're looting the houses of Russians.
Yeah.
So there isn't a kind of a nationalist response. And I compare it to when the Russians invaded Kherson in southern Ukraine. There were videos of big demonstrations of people waving Ukrainian flags. There's a famous video of an old woman walking up to the Russian soldier and giving him sunflower seeds and says, well, this is so when you die, you can fertilize the flowers. Your body can fertilize the flowers. I mean, and you see the Russians complaining. They call us orcs. Well, as you remember from Lord of the Rings, orcs were these big knuckle-dragging monsters. And so the Russian soldiers are quite offended that the people they're trying to liberate are calling them orcs. Well, we've seen none of that from Kursk. What we've seen is kind of people saying, we just want to get out of the way. Hmm. We want to get out of there and let the other people sort this out. So it's interesting. I mean, because there was partisan warfare in Belarus and Ukraine against the Nazis during World War II, partly organized by the Soviet shadow government, partly Jewish folks who were on the run, partly anti-Soviet partisans. There were a lot of those in Ukraine. But we're not seeing that. We're not seeing anti-Ukrainian partisans. Maybe it'll come.
Yeah. Well, and any of those turns can happen in a situation like this, right, where events on the ground change things, and that can happen in any conflict like this, I assume. Jim Brook is my guest here this morning on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM. He's the Ukraine-Russia columnist for the New York Sun. I've also written for Bloomberg News, the New York Times, Voice of America, and many other outlets throughout your career. So, Jim, tell me where this leaves Putin long term, because it seems to me, as we've been speaking over this morning program, that Putin is weakened by this in the long term. And of course, no leader, whether they're a democratic leader or a dictator or anyone, they don't stay there forever, but the culture does stay for a long time. Does this put him in any danger of being ousted anytime soon, or does he hold on to that power as long as possible, no matter what happens in Ukraine?
Difficult to answer that because this is the biggest crisis since his private military contractor turned on him about 14 months ago and led an armed column toward Moscow. That was the Prigozhin Wagner revolt of June of last year. So this is, you know, we had two big crises in 1 year.
And that could have turned into a major coup also, right? It just dissipated. He put it down, but still.
It stopped short, which is always a mystery. And surprise, surprise, the guy was rubbed out 2 months later.
Right.
You know, I think it's Churchill who said that trying to follow Russian politics, it's like bulldogs fighting under a rug. You know, you hear noises, you hear yelps and barks, maybe you see a bloody bone thrown out. But you don't really know what's happened until the victor emerges. And we may have that where there's someone biding his or her time. It was very interesting that last week, Oleg Deripaska is one of the five richest men in Russia, called Russia's war in Ukraine mad. That's in quotes, M-A-D, mad. And so there should be immediate ceasefire. A lot of people are thinking that. If you say that, you end up in jail.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a metals billionaire, you can probably get away with it. But
very few people probably at this point can get away with it. Only the most powerful of the oligarchs, right? And Putin has taken down some of those powerful oligarchs too. So they're probably watching their back.
Yeah, and earlier you alluded to what's going on, how this might impact the U.S. election, and I don't think it'll have a huge impact, but, you know, Kamala Harris was here in Pittsfield just 2 or 3 weeks ago. Biden knew a lot about Ukraine. When I was in Ukraine, it was during the Obama period, and Obama just didn't like Russia or Ukraine and basically handed the baton to Vice President Biden. And so Biden made about 5 trips as vice president to Ukraine and knew the dossier pretty well. Meanwhile, his devious son Hunter had this no-show job with a Ukrainian energy company, Burisma.
Right.
But actually never showed up in Ukraine. They had their board meetings in Monaco. And for that, he's getting $50,000 a year. I've always tried to get these kind of jobs, but
no. Doesn't seem to work out for us, though, does it?
Biden, Brooke, I mean, they're sort of similar. But but Biden knew and knows Ukraine very well and has kind of forged this coalition, energized the Germans and the French and the British who didn't need energizing. And really, I think there's a momentum. And so Kamala Harris will sort of inherit this. And she's been to the Munich Security Conference. She's met a couple times with Zelensky. I think she knows the dossier, essentially. I don't expect a big change. Now, some people say that one sort of hidden motive of this invasion of the Kursk region by Zelensky is to impress the West that, hey, we're still alive, we're still active, we can still pull off successful military operations using your equipment. It's almost all NATO-donated equipment. So I think, you know, the Harris campaign is probably taking this into account. Now, if Trump is elected, that's a bit of a roll of the dice. He's never shown a lot of sympathy for Ukraine, and his vice president, J.D. Vance, has been really hostile. It's kind of strange because he comes from Ohio, which has a powerful Ukrainian-American minority.
Interesting.
Marcy Kaptur is head of the Ukraine caucus in the U.S. Congress. She's from Ohio. But I have a friend who, Ukrainian-American, used to run the Ukrainian service of Voice America, and he just said, J.D. Vance has consistently refused to meet with the Ukrainian community in Ohio, and was famously quoted, "I couldn't care less what happens in Ukraine." Then he went to the Munich Security Conference last February, 6 months ago. There was a bipartisan Republican Democrats went in to see Zelensky and his foreign minister. The only person who refused to go into the room was J.D. Vance. You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
And he told Politico, "I wouldn't have learned anything." Well, you know, that's an interesting way to go through life where you feel you don't learn anything by meeting new people. And then he went back to Washington and fought tooth and nail against military aid to Ukraine. So for Ukrainians, frankly, this is kind of scary because J.D. Vance, at least 3 or 4 weeks ago, was kind of positioned as the heir to Trumpism. The younger, more vigorous politician, and basically it would not be good for Ukraine if he were in the wherever vice president said. I guess they have an office in the White House.
Yeah. Well, it does seem like, as you describe it, the Ukraine-Russia war may not impact the presidential election as much as, let's say, domestic politics or some of the bigger issues here on this side of the ocean. However, the result of the presidential election may have deep consequences for what happens in Ukraine, depending on which way this election goes.
Yeah, and we as Americans, we love to think we're the belly button of the universe, which, yes, we are, and that everything depends on what we want. Ukrainian nationalism has been a factor for 150 years, they will not go away because of the switch in the White House. And I think back when I was a kid, I used to go to the ethnic fair in Pittsfield, and there was a little sort of orange and green booth that was collecting money for Northern Ireland for the IRA. They call themselves NORAID. Look at the Northern Irish problem or issue. That took about 30 years to defuse, and not all of them came in from the cold. To turn off the Ukrainian armed resistance to Russia, that has to be a political settlement acceptable to just about everyone in Ukraine. It cannot be decided. I mean, Trump said he could solve it in a weekend or something. That's wishful thinking. This is a long-running grievance the Ukrainians have against the Russians, and it will not go away with some magical deal cooked up, you know, between the election and the inauguration.
Yeah, and as many of the various conflicts that are going on right now around the globe, this particular one also involves, you know, a fairly large country with a large stockpile of nuclear weapons. I mean, you can't not think about that when you think about the consequences that, you know, what ultimately happens with this conflict, and whether, you know, you back Putin into the corner, as I've heard described. He had experiences in his younger days with rats. And I think you've probably heard the story, right, about backing a rat into a corner. And that's, I think, probably what the world still needs to be concerned with as they navigate this this conflict in Ukraine.
Yeah, it's sort of a psychological corner, because don't forget, he runs the largest country in the world. There's plenty of, he can just go back to his own country, you know, stop invading another country and just withdraw. And controlling the media the way he does, he could probably spin a withdrawal defeat as a victory. You know, we fought against NATO. You know, we broke NATO's back. And he could probably spin it fairly well. If they lose Crimea, that's a toughie for Putin. And yes, the nuclear thing is very worrying. Putin has delegated his former president, Dmitry Medvedev, to sort of be the pit bull who sends out, and he's said to be quite a big drinker, so we don't know if he's firing off tweets when he's had a few whiskeys. But they're basically threatening nuclear war and saying, we'll drop nuclear bombs on Berlin, Paris, and London. And what is equally scary is that the primetime talk shows, the Russian equivalent of 60 Minutes, you have these guys get up there ranting and raving about using nuclear weapons. Just another one 2 days ago saying we need to have, you know, quote, surgical strikes with nuclear weapons. But breaking the 80-year nuclear, the taboo has lasted since Nagasaki and Hiroshima of using nuclear weapons.
And Jim Brook, I think we're getting close to the end of the show here. I think we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a fascinating conversation, as it always is, speaking with you here on Morning Drive. I want to thank you for giving us your time this morning and insight into some of these issues that, again, we may not always be paying perfect attention to here in the U.S. We tend to be a bit isolated in those areas, but these are big, big issues in the world, and it's good to have your perspective on those here on the show this morning. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Sean. It's been very interesting, and if listeners want more or an update 1 month from now, on September 25, I'm talking to Ollie, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, another Zoom call, and we'll see where things are 1 month from now.
Very interesting. Thanks. I think people should definitely jump in, especially Ollie members. Think about that that talk with James Brook. All right, thanks again for being here, and folks, enjoy your weekend. Morning Drive will return next week. Thank you very much.